Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Forgotten Conservative. It is 7/23/2022, July 23rd, 0244 as I speak. Not sure if I time stamped hour one, but that's right. I got carried away with the Aaron Lewis whole thing. Again, apologize for stepping on Aaron Lewis in that song, but you know, it's funny. I have said for most of my life, this noggin, this gray matter, is a gift, and I'm very thankful to the good Lord that I'm blessed with it. On the other hand, I don't want to complain because I always say it's a curse, and I've heard people say, oh, I don't say that, you know, but it just grabs me. For instance, obviously that song, playing that song, I've heard that song, and I've made a couple of comments at that stage when he says about, you know, no longer listening to blankety blank Springsteen. And you know, I've commented a couple of times here and there. Said some things I probably shouldn't have. Definitely politically incorrect. I don't care. Hopefully I covered that in hour one. But also, later on in the podcast, so for the song, it just hit me as it was playing, out of the blue. So later on in the podcast, I talked about during the, what do you call it, the booting up process of this Jurassic Park computer, that it just hit me about using this man's property. And I thought it was extremely important to address and kind of show the example of how slowly but surely we lose our freedoms and rights and liberties, not necessarily rights, but limited, infringed upon. And not me playing a man's song is as severe. It's still wrong. It's still his property. You know, I assume he wrote it. He played the music in the video. He sang the song. So I'm assuming that every bit of that is his property. If another man wrote it, then I've just taken and used free will. Is that right? Not free will. Taken for granted that man's property. So that hit me during that process, and I thought it was important to address. And I have talked about that song before. And I thought about this during my break. You know, I refilled my unsweet tea and re-upped my barley and hops. And I thought, and it occurred to me, I remember discussing that song, and it didn't dawn on me about the property aspect. So maybe that's hypocritical of me, or it was. Now that it has dawned on me, I have to do something to correct myself. I don't even want to think about it right now. I want to keep going, keep recording. I've got shit to say that hopefully is intriguing to the listener. But if not, I'll have a good time riding a ride. Speaking of intriguing to the listener, one of the odd questions that I get in emails, you know, just more than a couple. You know, I've talked about liking beer, alcohol. And a lot of people ask, what's your favorite brand? What do you like to drink? Now, there's a gazillion other things I would think would be most, you know, more important on your mind. But nevertheless, I'd read those emails before, and it just dawned on me that I've never addressed it. So for beer, I like Busch Light. 16 ounces, and it's a method to my madness, my part of how my nerdy analytical brain works. 4 packs of 16 ounces now, with, you know, inflation, it's around $5. I can get a deal 2 for $9. So I get 8 tall boys, 16 ounces. A 6-pack, 6 12, is, I think it's 8 ounces more than a 4-pack. So you get 8 ounces, which is 2/3 of the whole beer, 2/3 of a 12 ounce. You get 2/3 of a 12 ounce more with a 6-pack, but you're paying like $2 more. So at least that's my rationale. Per ounce price, the 4 16 ounces are cheaper. And I love the taste of it. Draft, I usually settle for Bud Light or Mick Light, Mick Ultra. I don't think anybody in the free world has Busch Light on tap. But nevertheless, that's the beer. I will put in a praise, I guess, for Budweiser in a bottle. If you can get a cold Budweiser in a bottle, that's my favorite. At least for like a couple of beers, say the ride home. Allegedly, I'm not promoting drinking and driving. I'm just saying, you know, if you want to fire up the grill or the smoker and you can throw a couple of bottles on ice to get those charcoals ready and so forth, get you in the mood, nothing's better than an ice cold Budweiser. And if I wasn't sure, Harry Carey told me, the late great Harry Carey. Anyway, alcohol, bourbon, but I won't turn my nose up. My sweetheart likes vodka, so I'll drink that if I choose to. So there, bourbon, not a big, you know, flat out whiskey drinker like Jack Daniels and so forth. But I do love bourbon. I could drink bourbon on ice, bourbon and water, and that's about it. Either on ice or add a touch of water. I don't, you know, not fancy. So that's hopefully answers your questions on my alcohol choices. So I, you know, there, I've received probably 6 emails about it. And that wasn't the only thing that was asked, but part of that, those questions. Anyway, so I want to kind of dovetail off of the end of hour one from, it was Archbishop Charles, I think, Chaput, maybe. And I'm probably butchering his name, but that's his name. You know, I want to give credit where credit was due. Very powerful, at least to me. And I talk about self-edification or reinforcing principles, resolve, just building, strengthening that again, resolve and backbone. I don't want anybody to think I make it a habit out of reading the Bible. If I hear like a lesson or something, or a reference to a verse that hits me later or whatever, then I'll go to the Bible. But I do want to go over a couple of things. Last week, I think I addressed the Big Bang. And of course, that was in, you know, the marathon on again, off again discussion of climate change. And my philosophy is that this earth is 4.5 billion years old. We're an anthill. We're a bunch of busybody ants. Just, you know, a gnat on the ass of history and the universe. I mean, literally insignificant. As far as scope, not insignificant as far as lives, souls, etc. So I believe, especially the carbon argument, and I've mentioned this, I'm sure I mentioned it last week, whether or not I've published it, that episode, that, yes, I believe in God. I believe in the creation. I do believe in the Big Bang. But I don't believe God made a system where we need oxygen and expel carbon dioxide, and trees and plant life need carbon dioxide and expel oxygen. It's a perfect balance. And I will never believe in a million years that, number one, that carbon is a pollutant. That wasn't until Massachusetts versus EPA. That decision was Supreme Court. John Paul Stevens authored the majority 5-4 decision that said that the Clean Air Act could be applied to carbon or something along those lines. But it was a split decision, majority decision, in 2007 that I don't even want to say allowed them. I almost want to say that the decision basically compelled them to declare carbon a pollutant or something similar to that. So, before that, it was never looked at as a pollutant. So, part of from that, and I'm not going to go a whole lot into this, but I know I should read the Bible more. But when I struggle with stuff like that, I want to look to it for answers, which I should do every day. We all should. But again, shoulda, woulda, coulda, and I'm not being flippant. So Genesis 1:1, okay? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was a formless and empty darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God hovering over the waters. Okay? So that's pretty much, we all know that. I mean, that's, in other words, we all know that. That's just something that's been common knowledge. You learn it in probably, I don't know if they teach it in elementary or kindergarten, but any type of whatever, you know. So when I say that I do believe in the Big Bang, but I also believe in creation, and it says in Genesis 1, in the beginning, God created the earth. But if you follow, this is kind of a literal, maybe a nerdy basis, I don't know. But when you think about the earth in relation to the universe, well, the universe is 13.7 billion years, Earth is 4.5. So in the beginning, in Genesis, when it says in the beginning God created the earth, so on and so forth, you're talking about a huge expanse of time between the Big Bang to Earth and where our story begins. So some people say, okay, that's a conflict of interest. It's a discrepancy. Even though you're trying to marry or merge science and religion and believe pretty much in both schools of thought or science, what have you, there's kind of a small discrepancy there in your argument that doesn't make sense. That, and I've heard this in person, and I've heard it from people who, atheists, etc., that try to dispute the word, dispute the Bible, dispute the existence of God Himself. So, to that answer, you turn over to John chapter 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing made that has been made. Let me read that again. Without him nothing was made that has been made. So, in other words, I contend in the beginning there was the Word of God, which in a metaphorical sense or a real literal sense, from all of time, as time existed, if you could say time existed, was God. Maybe I don't know if omnipresent is accurate or the right word, but John 1 is saying, in the beginning, there was a Word. So before the earth, before Genesis 1, God did exist. There, and he starts out with the Word. And then he says that the Word was God. And then he says that he was with God. So I think that John 1 is basically telling us the Holy Trinity, and he's summing it up right there from the beginning. That he's summing it up right there. And stuff like that, you know, obviously it intrigues me for the thought, you know, trying to figure it out. Because stuff like, you know, I can't help it. I think about stuff like that. But I also use the Bible in that manner. That, and I've never really thought about it. I've heard discussions on along those lines. I've never really quite heard it associated with the Big Bang, etc. I'm sure it's been said hundreds of times. It's just it had never really hit my ears, and you know, just kind of something that I think about. Just like, by the way, correction, I said last week about the Carboniferous period, the dinosaurs thriving. I was wrong. I thought I had my timeline wrong, but again, most of that stuff comes from memory, and so I went ahead and went with it. It turns out in this case that the Carboniferous period preceded the dinosaurs. I think like over 100, 150 million years. So, however, because of the plant life, it is widely held that specifically due to that period, it led to the first creatures, you know, I guess basically coming out of the sea, whatever that evolution deal is. But again, there were no dinosaurs in the Carboniferous period, as I stated last week. I corrected that at the bottom in my description and whatever hour that was, but in case somebody misses it, I do want to correct it in the podcast itself. Again, the example or the point to that still stands on its own, that the carbon has fluctuated, been more than twice what it is now. It's been less than what it is now. And humans have no control over it. I mean, obviously we expel stuff to an extent, but again, 0.04% of the total atmosphere is carbon. 0.04%. So it's just, again, it's just another method to control the people and the economy. And I can honestly say that, and I thought about this, I don't know, that morning after, you know, I finished recording, maybe at some point soon thereafter, and I was thinking to myself, that's when the Carboniferous period started nagging me. nag, nag, nag like my ex-wife. And finally, I had to look it up and was like, oh shit, no wonder it's nagging me. Nevertheless, so, you know, I'm thinking about all of this, and it dawned on me. We were nowhere near close enough to attempt this war on energy. And that's, I may refer to it as a battle, but ultimately it is a war comprised of many battles. So this war on energy, it's obvious we were not ready. Had we not had COVID and the pandemic, had these governors, bureaucrats, leaders, these agencies, OSHA, CDC, FDA, blah, blah, blah. Had we not had the government of one form or another able to exert control, to modify behavior, to pick and choose who gets to do what, lifestyles, businesses staying open or closing or going belly up. Had we not experienced that pandemic and the government started with that control, and it's not over. The COVID bullshit's not over. California's, the city's already gone ape shit. Here's an example. Oh, we got to start masking up again. We don't want to spread the COVID. It's not over. Starting July 29th, if you're in the city building or government or whatever, a bus, you got to wear a mask. Panic, panic, fear, fear. Starting July 29th. Well, dadgum. If it's that bad, why are you waiting a week and a half, 2 weeks? This came out several days ago, which defies all logic. If it's truly what you say it is, dadgummit, sign that executive order or whatever in LA, if it's a city ordinance, whatever it is, put that sumbitch into effect yesterday. You've got a diehard emergency that's, you know, the next coming of the Black Plague, and you're giving everybody 2 weeks to spread it and become infected. So it's little things like that that demonstrate that it's not what they say it is. You know, I thought of an analogy between our 1 and 2. You know, sometimes if people get distracted, they'll use this phrase, squirrel. And, you know, the squirrel gets me every time. The shiny object. And so this is all part of that same type of, I don't want to say game, because it's certainly more serious than a game, but this illusion that they play, that we're doing this in the name of COVID, but that's not our overall goal. We're going to backdoor you with control in whatever way we choose, but we're using the excuse of COVID, the vaccines, the masks, all the horseshit that people had to go through. The military vaccine are being discharged, less than honorable, I think. I'm not sure, but I know they're not given honorable discharges. People, 19 years, 18, 19 years, close to retirement, bam, gone, or get the jab. What are you doing that, you know, I've mentioned a friend of mine, she just retired from the Navy. In fact, this is like right around her 1 year anniversary that she retired. 20 years, 21 years or so. Now, I think she was home at the end working remote. I've never asked her about getting the jab. And, you know, it would be out of curiosity, but it's truly the control. And what better method of control than controlling the very commodity that drives the economic engine. This effing joke, embarrassment, Biden goes over to Saudi Arabia. I think the dude went over there and kissed a guy's ass. I just can't get it out of my mind. Because Biden's always been the one to talk a big game, but he's always been weak, so to speak. You know, he'll talk a big game, but in the arena of ideas and debate, he knows his brain is insufficient to back up his policies, philosophies, etc. And so when you don't have that kind of confidence, or, you know, quite possibly you don't have 100% faith in what you're trying to sell us, it's tough to back that up with any conviction. Now, that's just my opinion. But you're going over there, and I've mentioned this before, the Saudis, Venezuelans, China, Russia, whoever has energy, has crude, has all this stuff. You know, China, 700 coal-fired plants, building 400 more or thereabouts. You think they give a shit how clean that coal is or burns? And here, these kooks are shutting down every damn coal-fired plant they can get their hands on. Nuclear. Nuclear is probably, as far as I know, and I'm open for debate, not that it's a big deal, but as far as I know, nuclear is the cleanest form of energy for, you know, emitting the greenhouse gases. Now, the waste, all that stuff, but we know so much more than we do 40 years ago, 45 years ago when the last nuclear plant was built here in America. Same thing with coal fire, 40 years or roughly. Look at how the technology's advanced in every facet of life. Every facet of our lives. We got kids that are literally, according to the government, you know, what do you call it? Wage. What's the D word? Demographic. How the government, the IRS, etc., look at poverty standards, the lines, the official line, you know, what makes you be in poverty, what's that number, okay? So there are kids in inner cities all over this country from, I would say, 6 to 10, maybe 12, 14 years old that are struggling, their families, their mothers, probably single mothers, but are living better lives today in abject poverty. Now, maybe they have to eat leftovers or something. I'm not saying it's ideal. But they have a better quality of life. They have more amenities. They have more potential. They have more choices. They have the ability at a certain age, well, hell, you know, the throwaway phones. They can probably get one of those. I don't know if there's an age restriction on them. By the minutes, or if you got Wi-Fi at home, or sitting at the McDonald's. And you've got the world at your fingertips. As an inner city, poor child. Most of them have air conditioning, heat, especially if you're in government housing. If you're a red-blooded American busting your ass at this point, maybe now working week to week or previously, and now you're basically underwater or robbing Peter to pay Paul or using credit cards or whatever, or you know, going from, you know, I just made 15 bean soup with some ham hocks. Make you want to slap your mama. That's how good they are. But, you know, it's cheap. You know, whereas before I might go get a 10-pound Boston butt. And, you know, I can eat on both meals for a few days. It's just me. I'm single. But I love beans and ham hocks. I love rice. And it's cheap. It's cheaper. So even though, you know, I'm still buying the gas, I still believe the way I do. I live with my same principles, believe in the same things. It's still had an effect to where I may still splurge at some point and, you know, get a ham or a Boston butt or get some shrimp and spend a little bit more for a meal that I know I can eat on with leftovers for a couple of days or so. But it's modified my thought process. For many people today, it's modified more than their thought process. It's modified their lives, their actions. Again, some it might be, you know, the husband. I know if it was me, it, you know, something like this, I would just say, hey man, I wouldn't say peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, but I might say get some deli ham or something, you know, and so we can have a decent supper, or, you know, some sacrifice along those lines. Of course, that would be if I worked a traditional job and had a traditional lunch, so on and so forth. But that's my, you get my point, that I would, you know, put my lunch or what have you on the back burner to make sure that we have good suppers. You know, hopefully together, but if not, that the kids would still at least get one good meal a day. That's how I would approach it if I were in that situation. Excuse me. A little bit of unsweet tea. But yeah, so that's how all of this starts. And none of it is by design. Because at this point, you know, this style, mainly progressivism, but there's a huge group or sector of the kooks that are Marxist, which is a little bit kind of differing, slightly differing philosophies, but pretty much still has the end, pretty similar, the end goals or the end results. In fact, they're so similar that they can compromise, so to speak, part of their philosophies to achieve the end goal. In other words, what's the saying? The means justify the ends. I always understood what that meant. I'm kind of learning, which I'm just going to say this, but it's come to my attention over the past couple of years that that's more of a liberal or progressive way, you know, outlook or perspective, that they don't care, that they're in for the fight, the march, the movement, and believe that the ends justify the means. Now, that occurred to me just in this manner of conversation. So it's kind of speculation. I'm not saying wholeheartedly that is a progressive or Marxist trope or platitude. But this version has, I mean, again, it started in Europe. You know, you had those early German philosophers, Hegel, Marx, Engels, those that started this movement. And it came across the ocean, and it struck these people again that just put themselves on a pedestal. Harvard, Yale, and I'm not putting anybody that's attended any of those schools down. But that doesn't mean that you can't take this abstract, this philosophy in the abstract and attempt to apply it to a free society. Number one, you're going to have blowback. A portion of the society is not going to willingly accept it. And so we're in that phase, roughly 120 years into this march. We're currently in that phase where they are trying to suppress the objections, the non-believers, so to speak. And I say non-believers not accidentally, because again, most of these issues, regardless of what issue of the day is this person's or that person's, etc., because it's such a wide variety, they're attacking us on many fronts, that with each issue and belief, that is their religion. And when you understand some of these philosophers, where this originates, it all but says it. You either stomp out, crush, or replace the religion. And it's common. I mean, if you think about it, it makes perfect sense. You know, you almost play the shell game, replace this with that, which is originally had to happen with these people who believe this horseshit in the first place. Either that, or they never had that foundational basis in the first place, which probably is mostly true. And I don't take it as an excuse, because I didn't necessarily have it. I mean, this is kind of the evolution you're seeing. If you're hearing this now and you're new to this podcast, you know, you've known me a year, two, four, 5 years. This is an evolution of mine. This is me trying to prove, or this is me trying to disprove the theory that I've said on here before. A leopard cannot change his spots. That's used, I know I've heard it thrown around by psychiatrists in that field, you know, those people that are experts, alleged experts in that field. Again, the theory behind it is you can't change who you are, so we just have to help you, medicate you, you know, shrink you, put, you know, sit on the couch, whatever. But there's no hope. That's what's behind that theory. And it's my job, for one, as an individual, to disprove it. So when I say my evolution, that's what I mean. So to further that point, when I say that these kooks, if there's a philosophy or an excuse, a rationalization to say, well, you know, they grew up in a broken home, or, you know, this, that, or the other, and try to rationalize that because they were not raised around religion, they grasped onto whatever they could. Horse pucky. Horse effing pucky. I don't buy it. It's an excuse. It's a rationalization. Trust me, I lived my life using similar type of arguments. Not quite, but okay. Similar types of excuses or rationalizations. Let's just put it that way. And at the end of the day, you can't. At the end of the day, it falls short if you play out the string. Because you might convince this guy or that guy or that guy, But, you know, I'll use the example. We just had a situation. I kind of chuckled a couple of days ago. I just heard the story. Airplane that made an emergency landing somewhere, I forget the details, for severe turbulence. And I've always used the example to people that say, I don't believe in God, I have this or that or the other. Well, by God, when you're sitting up there at 35,000 feet and you hit severe turbulence and your asshole again shrinks up where you can't get a greased needle up that sucker, first thing you're going to be doing is looking up saying, God help me, forgive me, something along those lines. But trust me, in that situation, out of instinct, before you even know what's going on, the first moment that that plane dips 100 foot and rocks back and forth or something. Yeah. And then your ass is in the tight sardine can bathroom cleaning yourself. You know? So I don't want to hear it. It's an excuse. And I say that from experience, a rationalization. I let or justified my behavior by pointing the finger, maybe. The bottom line is I allowed another's behavior, words, attitudes to affect mine. Now, you know, fast forward a second marriage and divorce, self-reflection, because I've used that. I've said that for years. And under the recognition that it wasn't in no way to absolve myself or make an excuse, but it was certainly not something to shy away from. If I could help somebody else, or if somebody else was, you know, kind of doing something similar, you know, I would just kind of not chastise or condemn them. I don't think that's the right approach, but I would relay my story and hope that something about it stuck. Because I know when it hit me and stuck, it hit me like a ton of bricks. And again, obviously it's nothing to brag about, the behavior. It's certainly not something that I would hide or mask. It's part of who I am. Again, I think I said maybe last week or the week before, if you go back and change one minor thing, you know, stop at that rolling stop sign, or, you know, don't be late for work and run that red light, or, you know, anything minor that's mundane that we don't even think twice about. That's how significant every decision is in your life. So that if you do go back and change something considered minor, all of reality would instantly change. And who knows to what extent? Who knows to what extent your meager, simple decision, changing that one moment in time, how it affects, literally, on a grand scale, all of everything, all of history, or what, I mean, of course, that probably shows my dorkiness and how my mind works, but hopefully you get the point. I can't change it. I can't shy away from it. If I can use it to help or teach, then yes, I certainly want to. And it's certainly for prevention, because no matter what somebody else does to you, says to you, treats you, whatever they do, for the most part, only in rare certain circumstances does that, or can that, or should that affect your behavior. And I say rare circumstances. You know, somebody tries to break in and you're sleeping there with your family. You know, obviously something like that affects your behavior. But a coworker, I'm just talking in general. People you run into, assholes. You know, maybe it's you and your spouse are at each other. Maybe it's been rocky. Maybe it's financial. Who knows what it is? Maybe when you guys have a disagreement, it gets ugly, verbally. But you can't allow, again, another's behavior, words, or actions justify or affect your own. Because at the end of the day, you know, at some point you're going to be standing up there in front of St. Peter. And you will be the one answering for your own actions, words, and behaviors. Not whoever, you know, you're trying to use their life to justify your decisions. Don't work that way. I tried it. Hell, I was quite successful at it. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't right. I realized at some point by something, some input. I don't recall. Oh, yes, I do. I can't even believe I've forgotten. I remember precisely the input that I heard that started the process. It was Tiger Woods' speech. I think it was here locally, St. Augustine at the PGA. Maybe it was Sawgrass, Ponte Vedra. When, right after that Thanksgiving incident with his wife and, you know, everything came out, all the secrets for the most part. And I listened to it. And there was a lot, you know, it's deep. Cathartic for him, I hope. But one of the things he said was, the rules to society, i.e. the vows in a marriage, the behavior, the lifestyle, those didn't apply to him. He honestly believed he had built the argument, he had justified, reconciled, and made up excuses and done this, had this behavior for so long that he didn't even blink. It didn't even bother him. Of course, everything was secret and private and so on and so forth. But as far as knowing that it's wrong, knowing that it's bad, you're committing adultery, you know, all those things. And he said, those rules didn't apply to me. And when I heard that, I was like, you gotta be effing kidding me. Because I knew that was the exact, precise, to a T, perfect description of what I had become. And it's like, again, it just comes crashing down. It's like, Now, everybody in the free world is, you know, trying to kick Tiger Woods' ass for, you know, his behavior and cheating and that beautiful wife. And, you know, everybody's mad at Tiger. So, does that mean he's wrong? You know, I'm still, in my mind, I'm like, oh, my God. And so, you know, that was one of the things that started this evolution. And other things have, let's say, hopped on board the train to come along for the ride. If that's a good metaphor, a good illustration, that coming along for the ride and other principles, qualities, values, morals, etc., have, like I said, have hopped on board and is now riding the ride, enjoying the ride, at least I hope. I try to keep them from getting off at the next friggin' stop. Which is not accurate. That right there is an example of old thinking. Even though it's a joke, and it was tongue-in-cheek, and the comment was, I hope none of them get off at the next stop. And it's that easy to slip back into it. This is why these kooks are good at what they're doing. Because here I am basically confessing, witnessing, you know, unashamed, but disclosing. And kind of looking back and understanding, trying to make a metaphor, illustration of my journey. And I say, you know, all these good qualities, hop on board and let's go for the ride. And then I make the comment, I hope none of them get off at the next stop. The reason that comment, even though it was a joke, the reason that comment is wrong, the reason that comment is using a flawed philosophy, okay, and it's me, it's all me. But the reason it's a flawed philosophy or it's a wrong way to look, those values, those morals, those principles, they are on the train, brother. They are on the train. They are here for the ride, and they are within you. Those values, principles, morals, they're not going to get off at the next stop. They've got a one-way ride, non-refundable. They are there for the long haul. The only way that any of those things I've mentioned, and the reason that this is flawed thinking, the only way they get off that train is if I stop the train and I say, step aside. That's the only way those things leave us. Which basically comes down to right and wrong. Okay? That knowledge, that self-awareness, doesn't just leave. You know, if you see a wallet on the floor at the convenience store or whatever, you know it's not yours. You know the right thing to do is to pick it up and take it to the counter. Whether or not you do it, that's your decision. Only you answer for it. But we get so caught up, and it's so easy to slip back into a mindset to say, and again, it's a joke. And hopefully this just hits home. At least to somebody. What do the kooks always say? If it can save one life? I'm not that dramatic, but you know, shit. But that good stuff inside of us, number one, is humans. But that good stuff our grandmas taught us, how to do, how to act, how to live, respect, treat others as you would have them treat you. Those things don't get off the train. We have to make a conscious decision to pull the brake, sit there while it takes over a mile to stop that train, come to a stop, and turn around and pick that moral or that value or that principle. We have to select it, and we have to ask it to leave the train. There'll be another one right behind this one. And that's how we should view it. That's how I try to. If I didn't at least make that effort, I wouldn't have realized the error in the statement. Which goes back to optimism and living, having the philosophy of being good and living right. Back again to Aristotle. Anyway, we are about out of time. I hope that I did not just, you know, lose my marbles there. And it's cogent and worth publishing, because I think it was pretty, you know, I thought it was good. We'll listen to it and go from there. But we will probably see again here in a few minutes, so break time. Thanks for listening and playing along and riding the train and tuning in to The Forgotten Conservative.